This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, this is Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we are the co-hosts of Why Food here on Heritage Radio Network.
We've both been huge fans of Heritage Radio since, I don't know, forever. And we are super excited to announce that Heritage Radio is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year.
Think of 10 years of amazing shows, amazing guests, amazing interviews. You have access to all of those things for free, which is pretty incredible. But we are a nonprofit, and we do depend on your support and ultimately your donations to be able to keep doing this.
So we are doing a big donation drive right now, and we would love to see your support. We also have some really great prizes, including
spices from my spice company, Burlap and Barrel. I will curate a set of 6 spices for anyone who feels generous enough to donate in the $500 category.
So go today to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to help support the overall radio network, or you can support us specifically if you click on Why Food in the designation drop-down menu. Thank you so much for listening to Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening. Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, career changers, cool, wacky, interesting people doing cool, wacky, interesting things in food. I'm Ethan Frisch, and we're joined this week by a guest host. Valerie, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm Valerie Lomas, and I am a food writer working on a cookbook and also a career changer. Thanks, Ethan.
And you may remember Valerie from her episode, like a month ago?
About a few weeks ago. Yeah.
So if you want to hear more about Valerie's really interesting story and background and how she wound up sitting across from me at the host table in the Heritage Radio studio, go ahead and listen to that episode. But more to the point for today, we are joined by Hetal Vasaveda, who is a chef and author of, initially, of the blog Milk and Cardamom, and then the Instagram account Milk and Cardamom, and then the cookbook, shockingly titled Milk and Cardamom. thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us about your blog, your Instagram, your cookbook, your style of cooking.
It took me a long time to get there, finding my style. But now I realized what I really love cooking is regional Indian cuisine, specifically Gujarati food, which is where my family is from. And doing the comfort food, the home food, the stuff you'll never see in a restaurant. And just sharing that.
So what are some of the recipes maybe in your cookbook? Some of your favorites. Give us a...
On the blog, I have a dish called Surti Locho. So locho just means a pile of anything, just it's a mess. And what it is it's chickpea flour, which you'll hear a lot because it's used a lot in Gujarati cuisine. That's cooked with yogurt, steamed. It's a cake that you steam it. It's savory. And then you pile it with 10 different chutneys and chickpea fritters, save. And you get it at a street stall, and it's a hot mess. It's the only closest thing I think of is a garbage plate from upstate New York, where it's just a bunch of stuff on a plate. But it's so good.
Oh, that sounds really good. Oh my God. Can you tell us maybe some more characteristics of Gujarati cuisine?
Yeah. So Gujarati food tends to be more vegetarian. Majority of the country is vegetarian. And it's very vegetable forward. We're known for liking sweet, and it's sweet and spicy or sweet and sour. We tend to have the highest number of diabetics because of that. We love our sweets. We love our desserts. It's just a huge part of the Gujarati culture.
And you bake a lot. That's your thing.
Yeah.
So how does that kind of play into that?
It was mostly because I grew up with hipster parents that refused to buy cookies and cakes for me growing up. So I was I'm going to bake. And I started really enjoying the zen of it. But then I realized my dad really also enjoyed eating it. So it just became this kind of, I like to bake and my dad likes to eat it all. And I'll never tell my mom how many slices he eats of cake. So it's our little secret. But
And you got into, I mean, you are a biochemist by training. You, as all of our guests, got into food later in your career. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that transition. What did you do before food, and how did you make the switch?
So, like every good Indian girl, my parents, especially in Indian culture, they kind of give you the option of like doctor, engineer, or business owner. And I mean, that's kind of really the only three options that you're ever introduced to. Like, I had no idea this was an option to be in work in food and make money. But I decided, I was like, okay, I'm going to be a doctor, you know, make mom and dad really happy. And I decided to major in biochemistry because I really enjoyed my organic chemistry class in high school. And when I was a freshman, my parents lost their jobs. And to pay for school, I started baking out of my dorm room. Wow. And cooking out of my dorm room and selling plates of food. So it was like out of necessity. I'm like, this is a skill I have that I know I can monetize.
What kinds of things did you make?
Oh my God, I'm so embarrassed to say. It was like boxed cake mix with like homemade frosting, or like it was always like
so
semi-homemade.
How could you?
Well, I had no idea. Baking is not a thing. Like, people don't have ovens. Like, maybe they do now. Some houses do, but like, they don't have ovens in India. So like, it's not something I learned from my parents. It was not like, oh yeah, this is your great grandmother's like brownie and chocolate chip cookie recipe. It was like I was on my own, and the box mix was the only way I could learn. And then as I went through school, I learned about the science of food and how like technique and method matters. And I started to challenge myself and seeing what I could make. I'm going to try and make a cake from scratch. Oh, like, let's make cookies from scratch. Oh, if I decrease the ratio of brown sugar to white sugar, I'll get this texture. And just kind of learning those things. But
Did you have any cookbooks that helped guide you as you were going on this journey to teaching yourself how to bake?
Yes. One was a textbook on food chemistry. and the Alton Brown, lots of Alton Brown Good Eats books. Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything. And there's Cook's Illustrated, I want to say, The Science of Cooking.
So everything was very much kind of like science-oriented. Yeah. Interesting.
I'm a method person. Yeah. Very like, there must be a reason why you do anything and everything. So it kind of gave me a better understanding of like how I can, like, why do you use baking powder instead of baking soda? And like, why does it matter if I'm using caster sugar or coarse sugar or whatever? Like, why does it matter?
Was there a recipe in those days that totally stumped you? Was there something that you just like couldn't get and eventually figured out?
Oh, it's like homemade puff pastry. I still can't do it.
I love making puff pastry.
I like struggle bus hardcore.
I think you may, like with puff pastry, maybe you just kind of have to let the science go and just like, just roll that dough and roll that butter and fold it and laminate it. And yeah,
I get so nervous. I'm like, oh my God, the butter's melting. The butter, the moment I take it out of the fridge, I'm like, it's going to melt. Hurry. And I think I just like rush the process. Cause my internal anxiety is like, it's going to melt and it's going to be ruined. And you do this for like, cause it's like a long process.
It's a long process and it's a lot of butter. Yeah. So it's like, it's, you know, it's an investment. Yes. Can you make it? I get it.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm screwing this whole thing up, and then I'm going to have to throw it all out and it's going to be the worst.
Yeah. Well, you don't need to make puff pastry, so it's fine.
So back to biochemistry. Yeah, what was your career in biochemistry?
I worked as a analytical chemist, studying pharmacokinetics of cancer drugs. Wow.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah. So essentially, after I graduated with my degree, one of the professors at the school, so every summer I did, I got a little like scholarship to do research. So I did organic chemistry research for all three summers I was in college. And then one of the professors decided to hire me afterwards. And I worked with her with Mayo Clinic and a bunch of other hospitals where they were testing this drug because it's shown to be highly, what's the word? The drug was basically shown to be really good at curing cancers and attacking them. But it metabolizes differently in different people. So my goal was basically to identify like what's the half-life, what's the best dosage for these patients. So I was like in the lab by myself, which had to be like 60 degrees because of the machine and the equipment that I was working with. And I had to basically develop a process on how to extract this drug from blood, because most drugs are, they dissolve in plasma and that's how it's extracted. But this did not. It detaches itself to the red blood cells. So that was fun. I was like forever covered. Like I had coats that were just covered in like blood splatters because either like something blew up or something happened. I realized, and that was by myself. That was the other thing. Like I was in the lab by myself every day. And I was like, this is not the life for me. It was like me and Elvis Duran in the morning show. Like that's what I listened to. This is like before I knew what a podcast was. I feel like it might have brought me some sanity, but I would sit there and listen, to like morning shows and work.
So it was very solitary.
Very. I was so lonely. I hated it.
So how did you get from being in the lab to, I mean, we know that you were selling food, you were teaching yourself how to bake, to actually starting the blog and the Instagram account and everything that's happened since.
So when I was in college, I would call my mom and be like, Mom, how do you make this, that, the other? Like, I have no idea how to make some of these Indian dishes. And my school was like 80% Indian.
Oh, wow.
And majority of which was vegetarian and the cafeteria did not cater to them. So I would cook. That's kind of like my target audience.
Where was your school?
Philadelphia, University of the Sciences in Philly.
Oh, wow.
It's a big nerd school.
Okay.
So I would call my mom and that, like, in order to keep the recipes straight and written somewhere that I wouldn't lose it, I started the blog and it was like Philly Food Girl and it was like a Tumblr account. And the photos are horrendous. And that's kind of how it all started. Like, Mom, how do I make, you know, khichdi? Or how do I make dal? How do I make this, that, the other? And
so how did you end up, like, competing on MasterChef? And, like, when did things blow up?
Okay. So basically after I was like, lab life is not for me. I'm out. Peace. I decided, okay, maybe I should just get a master's degree because what do? You accumulate degrees until you figure out what you want to do.
Yes. This is what we do.
Yeah. Like that's pretty much how my parents and a lot of, I think, South Asian parents see it is like, well, you don't want to do this. Okay. Get another degree. So that's what I did. I decided to get my master's in biomedical sciences and I was like, okay, I'll work in healthcare. So at that time, then while I was in grad school, I was working as a nanny and then I cooked for the family. So I'd make their dinners and I had like so many jobs. I worked like as front of house for a small like Greasy Spoon diner, just kind of hustling to like pay my rent essentially. And I was in medical, I did medical billing. That led me to go work at Columbia University Medical Center, where I was a reporting analyst, where I got to be like deep in numbers every day and use my like spreadsheet skills. And I hated it. Got a consulting job in San Francisco in healthcare, where I fought insurance companies for underpaid bills. So basically anytime a patient was like, this is deemed medically unnecessary, we will not be paying. It was my job to go in and be like, no, but like, actually you should pay this. And this is why. So I did that. And my husband saw me absolutely hating it. Like, I hated it.
Were you keeping up with your blog during this time?
I was. So what I would do is, like, I would talk to my team and I'd be like, yo, if we meet our goals this month, I'll make this cake. And if we failed, I'd make a fail cake. And, like, my managers would be like, hey, we have a client meeting. Can you, like, bake some pastries for that client meeting? Or
right. So you're going through all of these horrible jobs that don't quite fit, but you're keeping up with your blog. Mm-hmm. And you said you started off with, like, Tumblr and bad pictures. And was the photography improving? Did you?
No.
Okay.
I would like to say yes, but no, not really. They were pretty bad. It was really mostly for me to have a reference point. It was not for anyone else to be like, that looks delicious. I want to make it. Like, I never thought it was going to be something that people would go to cook off of. Mm-hmm. It was just me to have, like, me, like, my own recipe kind of book for me. And then my husband saw I was upset and was like, quit. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, there's no quit. I've been working and hustling for, like, you know, 8 years. I've never had any financial backing to do things and pursue things I wanted to do. It was not an option. And it took him, like, literally 4 months to be like, just quit. You're so unhappy. Like, why are you putting yourself through this? I will take care of you. Like, just quit and do something differently. So instead we arrived on, you will try out for MasterChef. Because I was like, I don't know if I'm any good. Like, you know, what if no one wants to eat what I make? And, like, the imposter syndrome. And, like, I didn't go to culinary school and all that stuff. So he's like, just try out for MasterChef. Pit yourself against these other home cooks. And if you do well, go into food. And if you don't, then maybe it's not for you. And you can always go back to healthcare. So that was it. It was like, Hail Mary, let's go try out for MasterChef.
What was the audition like?
So the audition isn't really crazy. So I, like, literally showed up at, like, 7 a.m. I was, like, maybe, like, the 500th person in line. It was insane. I think 2,000 people tried out that day in San Francisco. And they bring you in 20 at a time, and you bring a dish with you that you have 3 minutes to plate. And they don't judge you on temperature or anything, but, I mean, there are people that brought, like, toasters with them or, like, cutting boards. And I'm like, you're really going to chop up some stuff in 3 minutes and plate it? Wow, like, you skilled. Because I'm not, like, that skilled. Like, I'm not like that.
What did you bring? What was your dish?
I brought a white chocolate cardamom mousse in, like, a salted pistachio nut shell.
Wow.
Yum.
I had made, like, 3 different desserts. I brought, like, backups. I bought, like, 4 different, like, the tarts. I made an almond flour cake with, like, whipped cream and, like, berries. And I was like, oh, no, it doesn't seem fancy enough. I'll do the cardamom mousse tart. They line you up. They have 2 judges. One tries 10, the other tries 10. And they, like, make their little notes, like, they try to intimidate you. Oh, how did you make this? Why does it look like that? You know, they do a very good job at it and scare you. And the poor girl before me had made a mushroom soup, and it did not, like, do well over
time.
How did
she plate that? Did it look pretty? I can't imagine.
God, you can make mushroom soup. It was gray. By the time it was, like, in the bowl, it was gray.
If you're trying out for MasterChef, do not make something unpretty.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah. I just put my tart on a pretty, like, plate and sprinkled it with more pistachios and was like, I done. Like, and I'm, like, looking at people making, like, swirls and swoops on their plates, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going home. They had, like, full meal, like, but they tried it, and then the producer, like, the other judge comes and tries it, and then the producer comes and asks me if I had an extra one, and I'm like, oh yeah, I have 4 here. And they pick a bunch of you to go into the next room. I got into the next room, and literally, like, of the 20 of us, I want to say, like, 7 of us got a chance to go into the next round. And they're like, pull out your tart. Like, they were talking about it. I'm like, all right, how about everyone pull out their food? We're all hungry at this point. Been online for, like, 8 hours. So we had, like, a picnic, and then they lined us up in front of the casting producers, and we're like, why food? Why MasterChef? You know, the typical questions. And they move on from there. And literally, I heard nothing for, like, 4 months. And they're like, congratulations, you're in the top 100. And I'm like, okay, cool.
How did you feel? Like, what was that like?
I was like, ecstatic, but at the same time, like,
did the imposter syndrome
come back? Yes, that's what it was. Yeah. Like, why did they pick me? Like,
because your tarts were delicious. Yeah. I want to try one. Seriously. Are they in the book?
Yeah. Or like, I do have a rework of it.
Yes.
But like, I think it's the idea of like, okay, they like me, but don't get your hopes up.
Right.
Right. Like, I didn't want to get my hopes up at all. Like, we got to the top 100, and they bring everyone into like a hotel in Burbank, and you know, I was like, oh, I'm definitely like, I'm talking to these people. They're like, I've been working in a restaurant for so many years. And, you know, like, I'm a line cook, and I'm like, oh, that's cool.
Was it like mostly home cooks on this show or a variety of people?
It was mostly home cooks, but some of them, like, you can be a caterer as long as you didn't make like the majority of your money.
Got it. But there were people with like real experience.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There were some people that had like gone to culinary school taken like a certificate course or something like that.
But you made it on.
Yeah. Which I was, and then like, then you start feeling like, oh my God, did I make it on? Cause I'm the vegetarian. Am I the token vegetarian this season? Am I?
If so, that's gotta be steep competition though. How many, like, oh, yeah. That's a,
everyone had a counterpart. Oh my God. At the top 100, like you could find your, there was like,
what do you mean a counterpart?
Okay. So there's like, for example, there's like, one girl that did pinup. But then there was another girl that did pinups.
It was like characters.
Like this, the characters. Casting
characters.
Yeah, they were casting characters.
And only one of each character was going to
Yeah,
make
you,
it.
Everyone had a doppelganger.
Yeah.
So who was your doppelganger?
I tried to find mine. I was like, who's the other vegetarian up in here? Like, I didn't know if it was going to be like the other vegetarian or if it was going to be like the other South Asian. There was like a couple other South Asian girls. My roommate was a South Asian girl from New York, by the way, who's amazing. She's now a chef here in the city. But I was like, who is my other half? And everyone had pretty much found like who their competition was. And I had not. And I'm like, well, I guess they didn't think about that for me. I was like, I guess I'm the token vegetarian. And I'm like, well, the vegetarian never wins. That was another thing. Like,
so what have you done to kind of like quiet those thoughts when they come up? Is there, have you... Like
similar to you, where I would like literally talk to myself.
Yeah.
I would talk to myself like, you can do it. You can do it. You'll be fine. Everything's going to be okay. Like, it'll be fine. They're not talking about you, or like, just calm down.
And you did do it. I mean, you were cast and you competed.
Oh yeah.
So what was the competition like?
Insane.
More of the same.
More insanity. As much insanity as possible. So what I've learned is like, after talking to other people who have been on reality cooking shows, it's like, it all just depends on who the production company and what channel you're on, right? Like, it really does. Like, for MasterChef, it's on Fox. It's very, like...
They want the drama.
They want the drama and the crying and the emotions, and they sure as hell got the crying from me. They just did, like, it's their 10th season right now, and they did, like, a flashback of, like, the past 10 seasons. And of course, like, the one shot of me is like me sobbing in the corner, and like, they're like talking about how like cooks are being vulnerable with their food, and I'm like sobbing and crying. I'm like, of course, that's what they chose to show. They definitely put you in positions where you're highly emotional, right? That's what works best. It makes good TV.
And you think they're sort of creating that environment?
Lack of sleep. Lack of personal space sometimes, days. Yeah, in the beginning. And then as it whittled down, you got your own room, which was even crazier. Honestly, I rather have a roommate, because when I had my own room, you don't have anyone to bounce, like, oh my God, like, wasn't today crazy? Like, you don't have anyone to, like, wind down with. But at the same time, you're like, oh, like, now it's getting close to the end and everyone's becoming more savage.
Right. What was your proudest moment on the show?
Oh, winning all the meat challenges. For sure. As a vegetarian who's never eaten meat, never, like, I'm like, literally, I use science to cook meat. I had no idea what I was, I'd never cooked steak before or any sort of.
But you won?
Yeah, I won the Beef Wellington Challenge.
How did you do that? Like, what was your, how did you do it?
Well, in the episode, they had us all sit down and, like, they, like, created this, like, fancy restaurant scene, and they put us two at a table, and everyone got to try the Beef Wellington, except me. So I sat there, and like, I got in my head where I was like, well, today's my day, I'm going home. And I started crying. I am one of those people that, like, every emotion just makes me cry. When I'm happy, I cry. When I'm mad, I cry. And at this point, I was just pissed. I was like, I'm going home today. Like, I was just so pissed. Like, why didn't I study? Why didn't I, like, work on this? Like, you know, or I don't know enough was another thing. But my partner, who I was sitting with, Chris, sat there and explained the flavors to me. He's like, Hethel, calm down. We'll be okay. And I went through and literally with a fork and knife peeled every layer apart. I was like, oh, there's thyme in here. Okay, there's this, that. And he's like, oh, like, you know, I could taste there's something like horseradishy or mustardy in this. And like, from there, I was able to like figure out what it should taste like.
Wow. So you kind of like reverse engineered the beef.
Oh yeah. I was all up in it. I was like poking finger, like trying to figure out like, what should I feel for when the meat is done? I mean, I was like savage. My hands were like I went full Indian, basically, and I was like ripping it apart with my hands, like feeling it, trying to get the texture, like how fine is a mushroom cut, all that stuff. I was like, what's a duck cell? I don't know what a duck cell is. I've never had that. So we had to go back and recreate the beef Wellington pretty much only from tasting, which I didn't get to do. And I ended up winning the challenge because I got people forgot to like baste their beef and mustard afterwards. And it was cooked perfectly, even though I thought I had completely overdone it. Like there was like a part where I like the cameras are there. Graham Elliott comes up to me. I pick up, you know, the slice, the filet, and I put it on the pan and no sizzle, nothing. And I'm like, oh crap. And Graham's like, you have to put fat in the pan. I'm like, oh, okay. Like, I no idea what I was doing. That's why I was proud of it. Cause I was like, oh, okay. Maybe I should trust my instincts and intuition more.
That's awesome. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned. Mm-hmm.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jimmy Carboni, and I'm the host of Beer Sessions Radio here on HRN. My show is an audio ale salon celebrating the world of craft beer, cider, food, and more. Through discussions with industry insiders and knowledgeable beer fans, my friends and I explore every aspect of the brewer's craft, from grains to pint glass and tasting to toasting. You can find Beer Sessions Radio wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
We are here talking with Hetal Vasavada. So we just kind of talked about your experience on MasterChef, but now you have this amazing cookbook, Milk and Cardamom. So can you tell us a little bit about how it came to be?
Yeah, so I've been blogging away, and I'd mentioned, like, my photos are terrible and it's only for me. And then when I got off MasterChef, I was like, I'm going to make something of these 15 seconds of fame. So I started, like, learning how to do photography. It was writing with a purpose and, like, with a target audience in mind. And I was just, like, building my portfolio. Because the thing is, when you go on these reality TV shows, you get a contract and they get to yay or nay anything that you do in the food world. So if I won, like if I couldn't have done a cookbook because it would have competed with the MasterChef cookbook that comes out with the winner. So I was kind of sitting on it, working on it for a while and building it. And I'd pitched a cookbook to a couple agents and I would hear, oh, it's too niche. Because it's about Indian desserts. And it's not just like the typical gulab jamun and like rasmalai, like the one you see at the end of like a lot of Indian cookbooks. I go into the nitty gritty of like mithai, which is like the small bites, and like the history and like the kind of stuff you only get at homes and again, don't see at restaurants.
Right.
And they're like, oh, it's too niche. It's too niche. And then, a publisher actually approached me, and I was like, oh yeah, I have an idea here. Like, here's my like proposal. I've already had it written. Take it. And they're like, yeah, we'd love to do it. And I was psyched.
That's awesome.
Why was it, important to you to do those kind of small bites, the home cooking dishes that hadn't really been written about before?
I think there's like two parts to that. The first part is I think less and less people are making things at home, especially these type of desserts. And there's less and less places you can find it. If you're not in, like you can get it at the Mithai Wala in India, but you're not going to, there aren't that many here in the US, that you're going to get that. And as someone that's like, I have a daughter, a 3-year-old daughter, and I want to expose her to these things. And these are the flavors of my childhood, similar to how like people make, you know, their great grandmother's chocolate chip cookie recipe. I want to have something for my daughter that kind of also you know, she knows her heritage. So I wanted to have that in there. And I think it's important for, you know, people from that are not Indian to know about these desserts. I think there is a place for them amongst French pastries and amongst American baked goods and British baked goods. I think there's definitely a place, and I wanted to kind of show it off and share it.
So, I mean, you mentioned earlier to me that you're a first-generation immigrant, and there's kind of a moment happening right now with first-generation immigrants kind of having a voice in the world of media, and particularly food media. Can you tell us a little bit about that and maybe how that has affected how you came about this theme in your cookbook and how that affects your recipes?
Yeah, I think there's been like this, I love that there's so many like first generation American, you know, children of immigrants that are coming out with these recipes that are so specific to them. And like their memories of becoming Americanized. Like for me, we had Indian food every single night. And I wish I had a book like Indian-ish where I could be like, Mom, look, like we can make roti pizza. Like, let's do that. Cause that's something that's my mom would recognize and something I could be like, that's so American. I can have that. But it's a story that I think a lot of people are now starting to, I guess, want to read or understand.
Right. I mean, and you mentioned like some of these desserts you can't buy here.
No.
But can you find the ingredients here? Oh, and
there's so much access now.
So do you feel like your recipes, are they kind of like your interpretation, or are they, and I know this is like a controversial word right now, are they authentic? And how does that play into your interpretation?
I struggle bus with that word so hard. Because anything I do here in America with Indian food will not be authentic. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't think there's like an authentic masala chai or an authentic anything. We all make things our own way. Like you can ask like 10 or 15 Indian people, like, what's your chai recipe? And they'll give you like 15 different recipes. Authentic is what's authentic to you and your family and what you have in your home. And I like, even when I was on MasterChef, I would make lots of Indian dishes and I would get like, well, that's not authentic. I'm like, but that's the way my mom makes it. Does it make it any less Indian? And I don't think it does. I think the idea of authenticity is, in my mind, false. It's.
So what is it? What is it? I guess what does it say to you when somebody describes something as authentic or inauthentic?
When I think authentic or inauthentic, it's the sense of, this is how they do it in the motherland. Like, that's authentic to them. I'm like, yeah, but like, that's how your family does it in the motherland. I bet you there's like 10 other families that do it way different. They use whatever ingredients are available to them. And that's what's been happening for years and years and years, right? Through colonization, through immigration. There are Indians brought to Jamaica and South Africa, Uganda, all over the place. And they made Indian food with whatever ingredients were available to them. Is that food any less Indian or less authentic? I don't think so. I think it just gets converted into that nation's food, that country's food. And I think that's what's happening now. America has so many immigrants. In the 80s, so many people came in from India. That was like high time. I mean, in the 60s or 70s, I had an uncle here and who's like, if we saw one Indian, we'd get excited. But there's a mass immigration in the late 80s. And I think now there's this whole generation of first generation American Indians that are now like trying to explain their food culture. Like, you know, growing up, I wanted nothing to do with half of these things. Like, because
half of the recipes in your own cookbook.
Because I was like, oh, it's weird. Like, my mom would pack, like, sesame seed brittle, chiki. And I'm like, I don't want this. Like, I want Oreos and I want, you know, whatever. Like, I didn't want that because, like, it made me other. And what I've learned, like, and I think a lot of people learn this when they get older. You know, I'm sure a lot of the lunchbox situation can relate to a lot of folks. I miss those things. And I realize, like, if I don't make it, no one else will. And Will there be another generation? Will I dilute the Indian-ness in my kids if I do not bring in the food aspect?
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. So I think like one way you share those are through the recipes, but mm-hmm. another way is through the photography. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you shot this book yourself, which is mm-hmm. like incredibly impressive. Can you maybe just share with us? I know I'm curious, mm-hmm. like what that process was like as you were working on this book, as you were writing it, and mm-hmm. as you were shooting it.
Yeah. So for me, I was like, photographing the book was really important to me because I really I've been trying to hone my photography skills, and I still am. I'm still learning how to like what my style is. But for the book, I wanted to show these desserts in the best way possible because a lot of them people probably have never seen before. Like I have magas, which is like a chickpea flour fudge that people are like, I have no idea what that should look like.
Can you tell us what that is or how you created that?
Yeah. So it's a dessert that you get in Gujarat and really all around India. It's also known as besan ki barfi, but it's chickpea flour that you toast in ghee until it gets super nutty and like fragrant and dark in color. And then you mix it with some sugar and cardamom and you let it set and it turns into this like melt in your mouth type of fudge. And it's really unlike anything I've ever had. The closest thing I could think of is like maybe halwa, like tahini halwa. But it is just so good. And my mom would make it for me like, so Indian desserts also have a reason behind them in the sense that there's a saying called mumi tukaro that means like sweeten your mouth. And you have these type of little bites like magas when something important happens in your life. When you graduate, when you're getting married, you have magas when you're pregnant because it's good for the baby, they believe. You have jalebi when you have a baby shower. Like there's certain desserts you have at certain important parts of your life to sweeten that moment, to remind you of how sweet that moment is. So that's another, like, I guess more cultural aspect of it. But yeah, the chickpea flour fudge is really good. And if you get the book, you should definitely try it.
was there like a sort of central recipe that it was really important for you to write down? How did you enter the process of writing the book and coming up with the recipes that you were going to include?
So the idea for the book for me was going from like traditional to what I wish or what I think Indian desserts could be with an American aspect. Like the cookies, I go from like super traditional like creams, custards and puddings all the way into cookies and cakes and tarts, which again, not a big thing in India. There's a couple cookies that are very Indian that came like when the Dutch were in India and they opened bakeries, and then Indian people were like, I'm gonna add cardamom to it, now it's mine. and like completely decolonize the dessert.
In authenticizing Dutch colonial
yes.
culinary traditions, yeah.
Exactly. But I basically wanted to go in with, I want to share the traditional stuff, but I also want to share what it could be because I want people to open up their minds to the flavors and like experiences of an Indian dessert. So I have like a gulab jamun bundt cake because gulab jamun is really hard to make, which is why, again, you only see it at restaurants. There's like a technique that I just cannot get down.
Gulab jamun is little balls. Yeah. Explain.
So gulab jamun is basically little like almost donuts that are fried in ghee and then soaked in a syrup that is flavored with cardamom and saffron. And they're not very easy to make. And I wanted the same flavor, but with something that's a little bit more accessible. So I did like a cardamom bundt cake, and then I soak it in the syrup that I would use for gulab jamun typically. And Indian desserts are known for being like extra sweet, which they are. They are very sweet. We love our sugar. But this is a way for me to be like, this is a new way to look at gulab jamun, a way that's not, you know, super saccharine and, you know, in your face, but a way you can enjoy at home and not be too scared of making.
Is there a sort of a, an overall takeaway that you'd hope that somebody who buys your book, who reads your book, or who cooks from your book, what would you hope that they now understand about Indian cooking, Gujarati cooking, Indian mm-hmm. desserts?
I want them to come away with, one, experiencing more desserts beyond the stuff they've seen at restaurants. I want them to be interested in the history behind the desserts. Because a lot of the desserts have a strong history in the spice trade. Alexander the Great coming and invading India and bringing a lot of Greek and European style ingredients with him, like semolina. Understanding that, like, again, what I learned as I was researching the book, there's no such thing as authentic Indian desserts. Mm-hmm. Like, the only thing I found that had pure Indian base was kheer, rice pudding. And that was brought over to other countries, like 2,000 years ago, like a long time ago. Like, there's like mentions of it in the Upanishads, which is like a holy book. But there, like, semolina pudding, a recipe, it's like literally the first recipe in the book, Siro, which is like the first dessert most kids have. It's basically semolina that's cooked in ghee. It's a theme. With a little bit of sugar, and then you add like raisins and nuts to it. But it's a Greek, has a Greek base. There's even a version of it in Greek culture. So it's like, interesting. Oh, the cookies are Dutch. Oh, those are from Portuguese, like custards. A lot of them are Portuguese based and British based. It's, again, is if you go to India, like, this is authentically Indian. I'm like, oh, but the history of it is so much more than that. And I hope that people realize that.
In the last few minutes of the interview, we're going to switch to a more kind of rapid-fire fun segment that we do every week. Regular listeners will be familiar with the questions, but we haven't really warned Hethel what we're going to ask her, so we're going to put you on the spot. If you could master any skill overnight, be the best in the world, what would that skill be?
Ceramics. I want to make plates and stuff. My retirement idea is to, like, just make plates for fancy restaurants when I'm like 70.
What would your plates look like?
I really like, I like the, I don't know. I guess I'd have to master pottery to learn, see what my style is.
Would they be, it's like beautiful, yes, but sort of same
weird
round,
yeah,
shape?
No.
Or are you going to,
like,
do crazy
fun, unique shapes? Like the ones you see in those fancy Michelin star restaurants that they commission. Yeah.
You're going to be the person, yeah, that they commissioned to make those plates.
That's the dream.
Got it.
What's your favorite recipe in the book?
Okay, so I would do,
like, what you would want to eat when you're craving something.
Mugga's is it. That's my favorite.
Which one was that?
That's the chickpea flour fudge. It's
that's
for
good
me
to know.
It just, I like, it keeps forever. So I like keep box of it at home and just snack on it. Yeah.
What's a recipe in the cookbook that your publisher or editor was skeptical about or didn't want to include, mm-hmm, and you really insisted on?
Good chunk, actually. No, they're actually pretty good about giving me a lot of creative freedom. But I think the one they were like kind of like, are you sure? It was a lot of the more traditional, like I have ladva or laddu recipes in there. That they were like, are you sure? Like, there's like, will people be able to find jaggery, or will people be able to find this, that, the other? And I'm like, yeah, it's on Amazon.
I have some in my cabinet.
Yeah,
actually.
I'm like, we can find it everywhere now.
What's your favorite ice cream flavor?
Oh, okay. I'm a goofy, I'm an ice cream aficionado of ice cream. So Humphrey Slocum, a place in San Francisco, has this brown butter ice cream that I am upset. They only have it during like November, like Thanksgiving time every year, and I will go buy like 5 or 6 pints of it. And obsessed. Like, my dessert is like that and a scoop of, I have a galette recipe in my book, Gugura galette, which is like a nut frangipane, and a scoop of brown butter ice cream. Yeah.
What's the best meal you've ever had that cost under $5 or $10?
Okay. It would be a falafel that I had in Israel. I just recently got back, so that's all I can think about. But it was in Carmel Market in Tel Aviv. They have a falafel spot. It was like $3. It was the best falafel I've ever had.
What made it so special?
They had the pickled onion, pickled onions in it. Really, really good. Because I love that tart. And then the falafel themselves are like just flavored really well. And they weren't mushy. And they were just, and the bread. Oh my God. The bread can make or break a falafel. Like the pita, if it's like dry and gross, it's just, the falafel can be amazing, but the bread, if it's bad, the whole thing is bad. But yeah, it's so good. I ate three of them.
What's the one kitchen utensil you can't live without?
Good question.
Okay.
Just this one.
Very specific. It is the Sur La Table Flex Rod Mini Spatula.
What does that look like?
It is a small spatula, like this big.
She's holding her fingers like 9 inches apart.
Yeah, like 9 inches apart. Yeah. I bought one, and then I realized it is like the perfect size for cooking for a family. Like, it's just three of us. Well, two and a half, I guess. It's me, myself, and my three-year-old. And it's just the perfect size to be everything. Also, it's heat-resistant. It's never melted on anything. Like, I have spatulas that, like, the edges are melted because I left it in the pot and the edge of the pot burned it. But they're just the best. And they're like rigid enough that I can scoop things. It doesn't like squish over. It's the best.
All right. Well, I'm going to Sur La Table. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, to move things with my mind.
What would you move?
Oh, I'd clean my house. I'd just do laundry, just wash the dishes, right. You know, just... I hate cleaning. Like, I hate it so much. So, yeah, if I can just clean the house using my mind, that would be great.
That's very practical.
Who washes the dishes when you're recipe testing?
That's my job.
Yeah.
My husband's like, well, it's your business. It's part of your work. You have to do it. I'm like, oh, dang it.
Have you trained your daughter to get up on a stool and wash dishes? Not yet.
Oh, I asked her to help me to load the dishwasher, and she'll be like, I think no, mommy. I think I'm going to go play with daddy. I'm like, okay, thanks.
She's got it figured out already.
Oh, yeah. She wants me involved in the cooking process, but she doesn't want to help clean it up.
Oh yeah. Everyone wants to like put the frosting on the cupcake.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to go to the store. Nobody wants to clean up.
Yeah. No, not at all.
But it's like, oh, frosting time. Yeah.
She's there.
You've got to earn that.
So Hethel, what's next for you? The cookbook is just come out or is about to come out?
About. So it comes out July 16th.
Okay.
I'm doing a book tour, so I'll be doing events in San Francisco, Dallas, LA, New York, Jersey, because that's where I'm from, and Philly. But yeah, just kind of getting that all done and getting my career, like, continuing to hustle.
You look so, downtrodden at this prospect.
I think it's weird because I have a full-time, like, I own my own company, right? I do social media for various restaurants and food businesses in San Francisco, and I create content and do food photography and recipe writing for some of them. And it's a constant hustle when you work for yourself because you have to find your clients. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, but I also have to do marketing and all that stuff for my book. Like, I got to, like, put as much effort that I put behind my clients behind myself. And I'm like, oh, my God, it's going to be so much work.
Right, but it's going to, I think it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
It's like your pot of gold at the end of the work rainbow of,
yes.
Of putting this amazing, beautiful book together.
Thank you.
Are there certain skills that you feel like you are able to draw on from your previous career, from your scientific background and training?
Yeah, I am a beast at analyzing why your social media sucks or what will make it better. I love being deep in the numbers and like, I will go and analyze like your last year's worth of social media, identify what works, what doesn't work, why people are liking certain things and be like, okay, well now you should create content centered around this and let's experiment and see if this works and really kind of use numbers to dictate how to get success on social media and get eyes on your page.
Where can our listeners find you, find out about upcoming book tour dates, buy the cookbook in a couple of weeks?
You can follow me on Instagram at Milk and Cardamom. I usually post everything on there. And then you can go to my blog at milkandcardamom.com.
And where's the book going to be available?
It's going to be at Barnes & Noble, Books, Inc., Target, Walmart, which I didn't know, but just saw recently.
Amazon?
Amazon, yes, Amazon. And a bunch of other places that I'm slowly learning because it's distributed via Macmillan, which has a large reach. But yeah, excited.
And before we wrap up, any piece of advice, recommendations for aspiring authors, people who are looking to make the kind of switch that you've made?
Mm-hmm. I would say just do it. Just do it. Like, if you're unhappy and you have the ability, like, I was very lucky that my husband was like, I'll take care of you. It's fine. And like the feminist in me was like, but I don't want to be taken care of. But I was just do it if it makes you happy. Or side hustle, man. Like, just side hustle it until you can make it into a full gig. Make it happen if it's something you really enjoy. You don't need to follow the path of your degree.
Yeah. All right. Cool. I think Valerie and I can both.
Yeah, I concur.
attest to that process. Yeah. Well, thank you as always for listening. I'm going to put in a quick plug for Heritage Radio Network as a nonprofit. Depending on your donations, we need you. I mean, hopefully you enjoy listening to us, and we need you to keep supporting us so that you can keep listening and we can keep talking into these microphones and interviewing really interesting people. You can visit our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Click on the donate link. If you donate $500, I'll give you a pack of spices that I will curate for you personally. If you donate in lower amounts, there are also all kinds of other cool prizes. I'm Ethan Frisch. You can find me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, Ethan at Burlap and Barrel.
I'm Valerie Lomas. You can find me on Instagram at Foodie in New York. I'm also Twitter, blog, foodieinnewyork.com.
And you can, as always, find us, the show, via our Instagram, Why Food Podcast, or email us, whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. And thanks to Jeet, our awesome engineer, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind. We will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.